Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello and welcome to Belaboring the Point. I'm your host, Kate Riga. Today, TPM's own Josh Kavinsky and I chatted with Serhii Plohy, who is a professor at Harvard. He has a new book out, and we chatted with him about kind of the state of the Russian-Ukrainian war and how, you know, really where goes Ukraine goes democracy at this point, you know, that it's a, there's much more at risk than just kind of the future of this one country, especially as we're seeing waning support in the United States, mostly emanating from, you know, the hard right flank of the Republican Party. So, Josh, what did you kind of glean from the conversation? What did you find interesting?
I think Serhii did a really good job of taking his deep knowledge of, you know, Ukrainian history and also just kind of like the history, I think, of ideology in the West and translating that into where the conflict is now and where it's the different paths it might take in the future. So that's like a really broad way of, you know, I think describing one point he made, which was saying that like there was this one moment where he was talking about these like huge kind of industrial wars that have taken place throughout history. You know, you have like all of these countries, maybe not even ones that are, you know, directly fighting each other, but these countries that are, you know, producing huge amounts of weapons and they're all just going to these front lines and all these, it's horrific, right? All these people die, but they also leave, as he said, these really deep marks on the kind of trajectory of the world. And that was sort of how he ended up framing the Russia-Ukraine war, was that, you know, there's a kind of broader question here. It's not just, you know, the issue of Ukrainian sovereignty, but there is this broader issue of, you know, whether a big autocracy can go and kind of quash its smaller neighboring democracy. And so I thought he did a good job of kind of framing, I don't really want to say the stakes. I mean, they are the stakes, but I think he did a good job of describing just, you know, the kind of deeper meaning, I think, of what's going on.
Yeah, I was really interested, you know, because he's like a historian. So he connected a lot of this to the past. And it was so interesting to hear, especially when we were asking about when kind of Russia and Ukraine split in terms of their, you know, how they were going to govern themselves. And Ukraine obviously, you know, went towards democracy. It was interesting to hear how in that sequence of events, you know, the 2013 kind of invasion of Crimea and everything was kind of built up people's resistance. It seemed that when Putin invaded in 2022, they'd already kind of like seen what it looked like when you know, their choice was taken from them and kind of shocked Russia in terms of that initial resistance.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting as well. And he said something, I think, similar related to that, which was like, then, you know, over the years that came after, you know, 2013, 2014, before 2022, you know, the parts of Ukraine that were not, you know, annexed or occupied by Russia, people, you know, ended up kind of seeing the government, basically their view of their own government changed from being this sort of like corrupt, almost foreign thing to being like a partner in their lives, right? I mean, democracy sort of progressed, I think, in the way that we think of it, like big capital L liberalism, democracy.
Right.
You know, and so when the Russian troops advanced in 2022, you know, they were, as Serhii said, they were surprised to find that people were loyal, walking around with Ukrainian flags because they were loyal to their local elected officials.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That was kind of moving. And so, you know, we're having this conversation at, as he described, a real turning point for the war. You know, we're at a place where it's not at all clear that Congress is going to be able to pass Ukrainian aid. It's becoming an increasingly less popular cause on the side of Republicans. And as you say, Josh, in 2024, if Trump should win, that likely spells an end to kind of any aid to Ukraine. So, you know, we're really at an inflection point in terms of the West, this kind of moral support of Ukraine starting to disintegrate.
Yeah, it was, I thought he drew an interesting contrast between like how the US political establishment is kind of organized, like how our political system is organized and, you know, whether or not things can get through Congress.
Yeah.
You know, with the majority that the Republicans have, where they could, you know, this, as you have covered extensively, Kate, it's like small, like radical faction in the House GOP can just hold everything else hostage. You know,
and it is. I was going to say, it's a good reminder that what is like, you know, we so consider business as usual, it's almost baked in. It's like good to have a reminder of like, this is complete minoritarian rule, right? Like there is a majority of bipartisan support for Ukraine still.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, exactly. He used that phrase that it's minority rule, right? Mm-hmm. But you do have like, you know, a deep well of like support in the like public, and it is still mostly bipartisan, I think.
Right.
At least to a degree, other issues are not, right? Supporting Ukraine. And so that, I mean, that's, it's nice to see. It's just like, I don't know. I'm curious what you think. Like, like what wins out in that context? In that contest, like these, like views of like the American people, or like, you know, the willingness of like the House, some people in the House GOP to do procedural radicalism. To kind of,
yeah. I mean, honestly, what concerns me more is where the Senate Republicans are, because you're always going to have a few House Republicans who are just, you know, kind of born of the Tea Party movement, or at least that is their moral home, right? And their project is breaking the legislature. So it's not even as much about Ukraine as it is, you know, I mean, I'm sure they do have some sympathy for the kind of Russian propaganda of like a traditionalist society or whatever, but their instinctual kind of reaction is always to just obstruct. But in the Senate, you have traditionally had Republicans who are more kind of quote unquote old school. Like, and even if they've come to the Trump camp, they do tend to have a little more respect for the institution, to take themselves a bit more seriously as legislators. And there, right now, we're embroiled in this totally ill-fated project to tie the aid to Ukraine as well as Israel and Taiwan to, you know, a border funding deal, which is just, I mean, could you think of a better way to kind of sink this aid than to attach it to immigration legislation, which we haven't done successfully in absolute decades, and on which Republicans have only become more hardline. And even though you have Democrats kind of becoming a little more right wing about it, because you can tell they think it's a weakness for them in the upcoming elections, it's still just, I mean, there's just never been more of an ill-fated category of legislation than this.
And I mean, do the Republicans actually want a deal on this, do you think? Because I mean, in some sense, like, these images that you see in right-wing media all the time of like chaos at the border, I mean, that's like good for them, like electorally, right?
Totally. I mean, it works either way, right? Because if they get some deal, they'll be able to say, you know, we are in the minority and yet we still bully Democrats into taking our ideas and to kind of help the border. And then when, as is much more likely, the deal inevitably falls apart, they'll get to say, we were in there trying to be tough on the border and these bleeding heart liberals just want open borders and everyone to stream into the country. I mean, there are a few areas where I think Republican rhetoric has gotten uglier than on immigration at the southern border.
All right. Well, I'm excited for people to listen to the podcast. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's an important moment in this. And even though I think we had an initial flurry of kind of Ukrainian coverage, and while that has faded a little bit, I think from most kind of mainstream news outlets, we're just at a really critical inflection point. This is a really good kind of illuminating conversation to catch you up to where the war is, what the stakes are, and kind of what we can be looking to in the last month of this year and next year in terms of kind of Ukraine's future. So here's our conversation.
We're talking to Serhii Plokhii, author of The Russo-Ukrainian War, The Return of History, a book which covers the events which led to Russia's invasion of Ukraine last year, the early course of the war, and the response from the West. Plokhii is director of Harvard University's Ukrainian Research Institute and a native of the country, and so he knows the story better than most. He's been writing about Ukrainian history for years as one of the field's leading scholars. Serhii, thank you for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You recount a moment in the book where after the initial invasion in March 2022, President Biden has what seems like an emotional outburst and says of Vladimir Putin, "For God's sakes, this man cannot remain in power." You wrote that at that moment, there was no doubt that the United States was back in Europe to lead its allies in the battle for freedom against an old enemy, and that the West as a whole was involved in the struggle. What about the invasion and Ukraine, in your view, led to that moment of unity?
I'm a historian, so the way how I look at things which are happening today or will happen tomorrow is through the prism of history. So for me, the story of the Russian invasion is a continuation of a number of historical processes. And one of them, the closest and still on the memory of many people around the world, is the disintegration of the Soviet Union, which came as a result of the end in the Cold of the Cold War. So the Soviet Union fell apart in December of 1991, 1 week after Ukrainians voted for their independence at the referendum for independence. 92% voted for their country to go free. And neither Gorbachev at that time, nor Boris Yeltsin, who was leader of Russia, really believed that the Soviet Union could continue, or that it made any sense to continue with the Soviet experiment without Ukraine, because Ukraine was the second largest Soviet republic in terms of the population, in terms of the economic potential in the Soviet Union. It also happened to be the Slavic and East Christian republic in terms of its cultural tradition. And President Yeltsin more than once told President George H.W. Bush that Russia wasn't interested in the Union without Ukraine because it would be outvoted and outnumbered by the Muslim republics, having in mind at that time Central Asia. So Ukraine played a very important role in the disintegration of the Soviet Union. And in the last 30 years, any attempt of Moscow to reinstate control over the post-Soviet space really depended on the position of Ukraine. So this is one of the reasons why the war, and the war of this enormous proportions, the largest war in Europe since World War II, is taking place on the territory of Ukraine and pitches Russia, the former imperial master, against Ukraine that struggles for its independence. And there is a number of reasons why the United States is in this struggle on the side of Ukraine. One of the reasons is, of course, the long history. Again, I'm going back to history. The long history of the United States, which came into existence in revolt against empires, which was in opposition to the traditional European empires through the 18th, 19th century, and 20th century as well. There is also a different dimension to the American role in this war and in this conflict. And this is the fact that the United States was trying to keep the Soviet Union intact until really the last months of the USSR. Bush had wonderful relations with Gorbachev at that time. The U.S. was very concerned about the nuclear weapons and whether they could, the Soviet nuclear weapons, where they would end up. So the U.S. was very much interested in the continuation of the Soviet Union as a junior partner on the international arena. But once Ukrainians voted for their independence and the writing was on the wall that the Soviet Union was falling apart, the U.S. accepted at the face value the issue of independence of the Soviet, of the former Soviet republics, including that of Ukraine, and really opposed the creation of the Russian sphere of influence in Eastern Europe. So independence for Washington meant independence. Independence for Russia meant actually independence conditional on being in Russian sphere of influence. So there is also this global contest that is happening around the issue of international order and what the independence of countries really mean in this world.
And one thread you draw on throughout the book is the evolution of, you know, Russian autocracy versus Ukrainian democracy. And how do you think the difference in the two systems of governance kind of impact how the invasion was perceived in the United States?
One thing, again, going back to the events of 91 and the fall of the Soviet Union, the democracy in the post-Soviet space really associated itself with the person of Boris Yeltsin. He was standing on the tank in front of the Russian parliament, defending the Russian democracy against the hardliners coup in the Soviet Union. And the expectations were really very high that Russia would become a beacon of democracy in the post-communist world, and in particular in the post-Soviet world. And that never materialized. So 2 years later, Boris Yeltsin ordered the tanks to open fire at the very same parliament, at the very same building that he defended in August of 1991. And his explanation was that the parliament was in the hands of the communists and nationalists and hardliners, and to save the democracy, he had to destroy the parliament. Well, 25 years forward, and you see, of course, Vladimir Putin taking advantage of this so-called super presidential constitution that Boris Yeltsin introduced after destroying, physically destroying the Russian parliament, and constitutionally really destroying one of the institutional foundations of Russian democracy. No one back in 91 really had very high hopes for Ukraine as a democratic country. The country was at that time very much in the hands of the very same hardliners who launched the coup. Ukraine was the homeland of two general secretaries of the Soviet Union, Nikita Khrushchev and Leonid Brezhnev. So there was the Soviet Union was very much entrenched in Ukraine, maybe more than in any other republic. But again, 25 years forward, what you see is at the same time when the Russian democracy didn't survive the 1990s, didn't survive the authoritarian trend and turn in the Russian politics, the Ukrainian democracy came to the fore defending itself, first in the Orange Revolution of 2004, when the fraudulent elections were rejected by the Ukrainian society, and then in the Revolution of Dignity of 2013, where the attempt was by the government backed by Russia to really not allow Ukrainian society to realize its dream to move closer to Europe, to create guarantees against authoritarianism. And we have a very different picture by the year already 2013, 2014, when the war really started. It didn't start in 2022. It started in 2013 with the Russian takeover of the Crimea. It started with the takeover of the buildings of the Ukrainian parliament, surprise, surprise, and then of the Crimean government as well. So by 2013, it was really not just a clash between the two post-Soviet republics. It was a clash between increasingly more and more authoritarian Russia and Ukraine, that already proved its determination really to stay democratic. And Ukraine is one of very few post-Soviet republics where democracy survived the 1990s and then the first decades of this century.
So, Serhii, I think for this next question, I'm sure we could spend days talking about it, but I'm curious if you could just, you know, discuss a little bit. Why did Russia move in the direction, like, what were the conditions that led Russia to move in the direction of autocracy while Ukraine moves towards democracy? I mean, why did one country go one path and the other country go the other?
What I see today is, of course, that back in early 90s, there was this euphoria about something that was called at that time and later as well as the end of history. And the idea was that really the end of the Cold War and the fall of the Soviet Union and democratic transformations in Eastern Europe really in some way heralded the arrival of liberal democracy as the not the only form of government in the world, but certainly the form of the government that is superior to any other. And that was the foundation for this argument for the end of history. And it was first made looking at Eastern Europe, and we can say that in Eastern Europe, in some way, the democracy, maybe not always liberal democracy, but certainly survived for these 30 years. But it didn't happen in Russia. And the question is why? Why didn't history end in Russia in 1991? And the answer to the question about history end really lies, in my opinion, in the history beginnings and beginnings of the Russian history and then continuation of the Russian history through centuries. The country and the society developed as an empire and as an authoritarian empire, that almost every empire is authoritarian. And expect that history ends today and tomorrow you have a very different society, somehow that history doesn't matter. Now we know for sure it's not happening in the real world. So a country that existed under authoritarianism is not just little tradition of democracy, but zero tradition of democracy or democratic institution, can't become democratic overnight. It can become democratic in the longer run, but not overnight. This is a historical processes that take time. Now, going to Ukraine, why Ukraine eventually, despite this being the homeland of the Soviet clans and party clans, why Ukraine became democratic? One of the explanations for that is that in Ukraine didn't have a history of the imperial existence, or rather had a lot of history of imperial existence, but not as an empire, but as a subject of empire. And more than that, Ukraine existed as part of the Russian Empire, as part of Austria-Hungarian Empire before the revolution of 1917 and World War I, and then Ottoman Empire also in the 17th and 16th centuries. So all these empires, they left their imprint, cultural and otherwise, linguistic and so on and so forth, on different regions of Ukraine, that then came together in the processes of the transformation of the 20th century. In 1991, that was the fifth attempt of Ukraine to declare its independence. So when this different regions of Ukraine came together, they realized that no one region was strong enough to suppress every other region. When Germany got united in mid-19th century, there was Prussia, the biggest of all other regions, and it created that unified state. Ukraine didn't have Prussia, or didn't have equivalent of Prussia. So Ukraine became an equivalent of the American colonies in the 18th century. To survive, you have to stick together, but you also have to come with some form of the modus operandi and form of coexistence. And democracy, the worst form of government, except every other form of government, as Churchill said, turned out to be the template, the roadmap of how country could stick together and develop. So these are explanations from history. Of course, probably if you would talk to political scientists, they would maybe point to other factors. But I certainly believe in history, and that's how I see different trajectories, historical trajectories of Russia and Ukraine, something that we didn't fully realize back in 1991.
Yeah, and I mean, we're interested in the historical context here, and I just had one question following up on that, which is, if you look at Ukraine's political history since independence in 1991, you've had a number of leaders who have they've had authoritarian tendencies. They've tried to become, I think some would say autocrats, but it's never succeeded, right? Ukrainian civil society has pushed back. So what do you think led to that? Was it that the state was too weak? Was it that civil society was strong enough to stop that from taking place? I mean, what do you think the balance was, which led to those efforts at authoritarianism to fail?
Well, you're absolutely right that a number of Ukrainian leaders were trying to follow in the footsteps of Boris Yeltsin. They really came to the age as political leaders in the Soviet Union. They looked to Moscow as a model for almost everything, and they tried at least twice to introduce a more authoritarian form of government, both times with support of Russia. And what they got were two revolutions, the Orange Revolution 1204 and the Revolution of Dignity in 2013. Around the Revolution of 1204, at that time, President of Ukraine, Leonid Kuchma, wrote a book which was called Ukraine is Not Russia. basically, apparently developing the argument that he made in private conversation to Vladimir Putin, when Putin was actually encouraging him to use force against the demonstrators in Kyiv. And Kuchma's argument, and to his credit, he understood that, was that the Ukrainian society would never accept that. The Revolution of Dignity in 2013 turned from a very limited protest called Euro Revolution into a really national protest after the police was used to disperse the student manifestation. So that was the red line for Kyiv, for the Ukrainian society. Whether they supported Euro integration or not, they certainly rejected the government that was using force against students. So the battle cry was, okay, you can't do that to our children. And that's certainly not the attitude that we had in Russia, including during the 2012 Bolotnaya Square protests, and then later protests led by Navalny. So the difference was there. There is a number of reasons why the Ukrainian society turned out to be stronger than Russian one. And one of those reasons is the weakness of the state. The weakness of the state, the Ukrainian project survived and emerged victorious in opposition to the state. The state was always imperial. The state was not Ukrainian. So for Ukrainian society, it took a while, not just months or years, decades, to learn to live in the state that is not foreign state. Say that is yours. And from that point of view, the year 2014, the war, the start of the war, became a turning point in which society discovered the state not as an enemy, but as an ally. And the state discovered society as its ally. And that's really the joining forces, society and state joining forces, that became a discovery of this new stage of the war of 2022. Because Putin's plan, the way how I understand it, with the so-called special military operation, was that there would be limited resistance on the part of Ukraine, of a sort that happened in 2014, when Crimea was taken by military force, but with very little resistance. And the expectation was that the society and the state are basically in opposition to each other. And it came as a surprise, not only to the Russians, but probably to many Ukrainians and to the world at large, that when the Russians started to take over basically Russian-speaking regions and cities in southern Ukraine, like Kherson, Melitopol, Berdyansk, These people were marching with the Ukrainian flags against the Russian tanks in defense of their mayors, people whom they elected and whom they trusted. And one of the arguments on the front lines in Ukraine when they were asking for what they were fighting for, the first thing was, okay, we just didn't invite anybody to come here and to tell us how to live. But the second was that they were fighting for democracy, for the right to choose. And they knew very well after 2014 that right was taken away from their compatriots in Crimea and in eastern Ukraine. So by 2014, they didn't know what they were supposed to fight for and what they were supposed to defend. They were taking democracy for granted. They were taking the state that was not interfering into their affairs for granted. In 2022, they already realized that that was a value that they had to defend.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Oh, that's so interesting. In the book, you write about how, in some sense, it's a, you know, it's a 19th century war, and about how Putin has adopted a worldview in his public statements, which casts Russia as a, quote, unique multi-ethnic civilization, not only different from the West, but opposed to it in history, culture, and values. And in the West, we've seen statements from Putin that echo a lot of our own, you know, right-wing culture war rhetoric, talking about gay marriage and cancel culture, things like that. You know, what purpose does that serve, and how does that fit into his view of Russia as a unique civilization?
Russia goes through a very difficult period of really coming to the terms with the loss of the superpower status. I understand that Putin was very offended when Obama apparently called Russia just original power, not a superpower. And also the loss of empire. So Ukraine, Azerbaijan, Baltic states, Armenia, Kazakhstan, you name it. That's not part of Russian territory anymore. And it's in search for the new national idea and in search for new ideology that would be transnational. So the communist is gone. The communism is gone. This communism, the Soviet Union could very effectively function on the ideological level in faraway places like Latin America, Cuba, Africa, and so on and so forth. And during the interwar period, recruit spies like Kim Philby, who were there basically to protect communism. So if you are now Russian nationalist, how far can you go in Africa, in Latin America? How many spies you can recruit at Cambridge in UK under the banner of the Holy Orthodoxy? Not many. But if you think about yourself as a defender of the traditional rights, this is a broader trend, and this is a trend that also allows you to present as a last bulwark of traditional values, a savior of Europe from itself, because Europe goes this horrible way of gay marriages and so on and so forth. That works in Russia, and certainly that's what is Russia exporting. I was in Kiev in 2013 at the start of the Revolution of Dignity, and in Kiev underground, which is beautiful underground. There were these posters put by the previous regime that was working with Russia, and they were all about gay Europa and gay marriages and other things. That was the most that was the way to scare the Ukrainian society, and that was also the product that Putin was selling in Ukraine. And it doesn't look, there are too many buyers in Ukraine, but there are buyers in other places.
Well, and I think we see buyers in the United States. I mean, it's come up in the context of the debate in Congress right now over whether or not the Congress is going to pass another aid supplemental to Ukraine. But I'm curious, I mean, you know, you see the sympathy for the traditionalist kind of project, propaganda, whatever you want to call it, that you just described. To what extent is that intentional? To what extent is that targeted on the part of the Kremlin towards potentially sympathetic voices in the West?
This is certainly something that is essential now for the really regime in Russia and for legitimization of that regime. And if you can also export that, of course, you do that. But what we see today is that Russia really doesn't function exactly in the way how the Communist Soviet Union functioned, which was ideological both at home and abroad. Russia today basically functions as a spoiler state, as a basically using whatever ideology available to destabilize the democratic systems abroad. So anything that works to destabilize democracy and undermine and discredit democracy is good. From that point of view, the leftist ideas and the leftist groups are not particularly rejected. The rightist groups are not rejected and embraced as well. So again, in terms of traditional values, there are more kind of a synergy between the Russian domestic policy and foreign policy, formal and informal. But the leftist ideas are not discarded as the instrument of foreign policy, as the weapon against the West. So from that point of view, Russia today is much more, I would say, flexible and potentially can be more effective once the communism started to lose its appeal, and that started already certainly relatively early by the 60s, 70s for sure, both at home and abroad. The regime lost one of its key foreign policy instruments. But if you have a bigger toolbox, certainly you can be more effective. And that's Russia has now a bigger ideological toolbox to achieve its foreign policy goals.
So in March of 2022, it felt that the West was kind of strikingly united in support for Ukraine. What do you think has changed on that front now?
Indeed, there was quite unique, I would say, condemnation of Russia. The President Biden did a very, very impressive job of putting together the sanctions coalition. So the last time the U.S. president achieved something like that was the time of the disintegration of the Soviet Union. That was George H.W. Bush. So working with the allies, that was quite impressive. But the idea basically was that Ukraine would, Kyiv would fall within a few days, Ukraine would fall in a couple of weeks. That was the reason why all the embassies were withdrawn, Western embassies were withdrawn from Ukraine. So it was a strong condemnation of Russia and moral support for Ukraine, but basically the idea was that nothing can be done about that. And the situation changed by April. By April, Ukraine on its own defeated the Russian attempt to capture Kyiv and forced the Russian troops to withdraw. And at that point, the West makes the decision that actually this is the country that showed its ability to fight back. So we should support it not only through sanctions and through condemnation of Russia and expression of moral support and taking refugees, but we can support it also in fight for its sovereignty and independence and as an extension of that also for maintaining the international order. And that story pretty much lasted until the last few months. Ukraine produced now with the Western help a number of additional victories in the counteroffensive near Kharkiv in eastern Ukraine, pushing Russians from Kherson, the only major city, the regional capital that Russia captured during that stage of the war. And the expectations were really very high that the counteroffensive that started this summer would produce similar results. The counteroffensive didn't produce those results. The front lines barely moved in this year 2023. And now we are at another turning point in this war. The first came in the first days of the war when President Zelensky refused to flee. when Ukrainians decided to fight. The next turning point was in April when the West decided to support Ukraine's fight for independence. And now we are in the moment of soul searching and finger pointing as well. Why the expectations of 2022 didn't materialize in 2023, and what to do with that? So my understanding is that depending on the decisions that will be made next year, year 2024, those decisions will become crucial for the outcome of the war, in general. So my look at that as a historian is that, and putting this war in the historical context, is that this is the largest war in Europe since 1945. The largest industrial war in the world in the last 70 years. The wars like that, they leave a profound mark on the world, on the international relations. On the outcome of this war depends not just this or that territory within Ukraine, and not only continuing existence of Ukraine as an independent state. On this war very much depends what will happen with democracy and autocracy. This is not just a cliche. Democracy is under attack not only in Russia or in China. It's also under attack in the countries with long democratic tradition. But the question is about the international order. And the example that one or another outcome of the war can really give, for example, China, whether it makes sense to go after Taiwan, or maybe it's too costly, and maybe it's the idea that it should be at least postponed. So international order, the future of democracy, and certainly the future of Europe. What will happen with Eastern Europe? Its history didn't come to an end yet. Russia continues to look at the Baltic states, which are part of NATO and are part of European Union, as it's not just historical, but also potentially future sphere of influence. Cyber attacks on the Baltic states predated the start of this war in 2022. So what I'm trying to say is just because of the scope of the war, its outcome will have a profound impact on the world and international order in general.
And I think just to point out, I know you're a historian, but this really is a question about the future. So we're in a moment now where, as we kind of mentioned earlier, Congress, it's very much up in the air whether or not the American Congress is going to approve further military aid to Ukraine. And if Trump, if there's a second Trump administration after the November elections, it's entirely possible that other forms of support which come from the United States will also come to an end. So what's the risk for Ukraine if those two events come to pass, if American support stops?
Well, the risk is pretty much to be left on its own with Russia, which has the population three times what Ukraine has certainly a quite effective military-industrial complex despite the sanctions. So the outcome can be the loss in this war. And again, as I explained, it will be more than loss for Ukraine. And it's also very, very dangerous for the United States, because at least my understanding is that there is a bipartisan support in Congress for support for Ukraine, military support for Ukraine. It was there also during the Trump administration. Actually, Trump got in trouble on the first impeachment on the issue of supplying weapons to Ukraine. He tried to get a bribe for what he was doing, for political bribe from Zelensky, but he couldn't stop the decision of the Congress. So the Congress and generally the American people are with Ukraine, but we have this very dysfunctional system at this point, where it's a minority rule to a degree, and this is not good for Ukraine, but it spells nothing good for the U.S. both in terms of the international U.S. international politics or domestic. So we are in trouble, and Ukraine is just on the receiving end of that.
Okay. Once again, Serhii, thank you for joining us. This was Serhii Plokhii, author of The Russo-Ukrainian War, The Return of History. Thank you again for coming on. We really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for your questions. Thank you for the discussion.
Thanks so much. Belaboring the Point with Kate Riga is a TPM podcast. The show is hosted by me, reporter Kate Riga. The show is produced by the excellent Jackie Wilhelm. Thanks to our good friend, Why Not Jansveld, for our podcast theme song. And thanks to our TPM members who make this possible. Rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts and subscribe wherever you listen.